is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billionaires!
And I'd like to welcome you one more time again to All Things Reconsidered, the weekly news or weekly variety show that brings you interviews and various looks at progressive stuff. My name is Bruce Birch, and I'm your host for this evening. Glad to have you aboard. And tonight, hey, glad to have you aboard. This is Bruce Birch, All Things Reconsidered, and here in front of me I have my list of things to talk about. I don't know if you can hear that or not. But anyway, I could hear it. I'm going to tune this down just a hair. There we go. Wanted to bring to your attention some things tonight. We've got, first of all, before I get too wound up, got a bunch of great audio for you tonight. We have a part two of an interview with Geronimo from Sacramento, California. We also have, and that's on the book that we discussed last week. If you hear this interview tonight and you want to hear part one, then go to allthingsreconsidered.org to find the archive for that particular interview. Anyway, if you would like to, you can listen to that later on. Also, we're going to have some interesting audio from a couple of gentlemen who passed away this weekend. One, Eugene McCarthy, who is a senator from Minnesota, who actually ran against Lyndon Baines Johnson, and in that audio, he's going to be talking about corruption in politics, as well as the principles of being a politician ought to be. And also some audio from the late, great Richard Pryor. So stick around for that. Let's do our housekeeping stuff. We are archived at allthingsreconsidered.org and also at whiterosesociety.org. Ben Birch does that for us. Fantastic guy. He archives a bunch of progressive radio shows there, and I encourage you strongly to go and check that out. There's probably, I don't know, probably over a million hours of stuff there, just an incredible amount of liberal programming. So if you're into that, go check it out. Also, you can reach our archives, the most up-to-date stuff, on our website, allthingsreconsidered.org. And let's see, we're also chatting in the Tom Hartman chat room. You can reach that by going to tomhartman.com, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, .com. And then click on the live chat link there at the top of the page, and it'll shoot you right into the chat room where there are people who are listening to this show right now. And I don't know if they're going to be chatting about the show, but hey, they're there, and they're listening. So go and check that out, if you would. Now, getting onto into the heart of the matter, as the song goes. A friend of mine has a friend who has a band, and they do a song called Heart of the Matter, and actually it's in another radio show that I do called Fourth Estate Radio. First thing I want to talk about, and this is just something that just really, it came across my radar, and I was completely outraged. Now, I'm a guy that, in my regular job, I work with veterans, and whether or not people choose to sign up and go to war, whether or not they're culpable for their actions or whatever, I mean, they have to follow orders, etc. So I'm not going to get into the wherefores of signing up and going into the military. But I do work with a lot of veterans, and this story sort of struck me very, very hard. And apparently, the military has been transporting the bodies of service members who have been killed via commercial airliner in the cargo holds. A local family, this is out of San Diego, a local family said fallen soldiers and Marines deserve better, and that one would think our war heroes are being transported with dignity, care, and respect. It said One would think upon arrival in their hometowns they would be greeted with honor, but unfortunately the family said that is just not the case. Dead heroes are supposed to come home with their coffins draped with the American flag, greeted by a color guard. But in reality, many are arriving as freight on commercial airliners, stuffed into the belly of a plane with suitcases and other cargo. I guess this would be called privatization. That's my own editorial comment. John Holly and his wife Stacy were stunned when they found out that the body of their only child, Matthew, who died in Iraq last month, would be arriving at Lindbergh Field as freight. When someone dies in combat, they need to give them due respect they deserve for the sacrifice they made, said John Holly. Both John and Stacy Holly, who were in the Army, made some calls, and with the help of U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, you go, Barbara, Matthew was greeted with honor and respect. They're quoted as saying that our familiarity with military protocol and things of that sort allowed us to kind of put our foot down. We're not sure other parents have that same knowledge. If you're outraged, send a letter to your congressman, or better yet, send one to the Defense Department and tell them to stop this practice. This is just, you know, it's just, it, you know, just when I think that these guys cannot stoop any lower, they go one step lower, and it just amazes me. Apparently, the bodies of dead service members arrive at Dover Air Force Base, and from that point on, they are sent to their families on commercial airliners. So there you go. Privatization at its finest. If you would like to, please join us at Tom Hartman Chat Room. We have an interview coming up very, very shortly, matter of fact, in just a moment, that is with a friend of mine named Geronimo. And in this interview, we're talking about, and actually, if you want to go to allthingsreconsidered.org, you can go there and click preview. And if you do that, click show preview, you will see the title of the book, and it actually has a link to the book on Powell.com. But let's go ahead and run the first half of this interview, and we'll be back shortly. This is All Things Reconsidered, and you're about to hear an interview with Geronimo from Sacramento, California. This is Bruce Birch, and I have on the line with me Geronimo of Sacramento, California, and we are going to be discussing a topic that we had started last week called, and it's about a particular book. Geronimo, it's good to have you back on with us.
Thank you, Bruce.
And the book that we're discussing is written by Stephen J. Ducott, and it's called The Wimp Factor, Gender Gaps, Holy Wars, and the Politics of Anxious Masculinity. Okay, well, let's go back to, let's talk about, you know, last week we did a really great overview, but let's get a little bit more in depth this time, if you will. And the first thing that I wanted to sort of get into was the 19th century and sort of setting us up for masculine or patriarchy in politics. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there were echoes in the 19th century of the same gender dynamics that are going on today. But I think the big thing that happened in the 19th century was that the nature of work changed, because between 1870 and 1910, there was a radical decline in male self-employment. Male self-employment was 67% in 1870, and it was 37% in 1910. What happened was that industrialization transformed husbands and fathers from family farms and businesses to factories and offices, and the men were put into a hierarchical work environment, you know, command, obedience.
Sure.
And they lost their freedom, autonomy, and risk-taking of being their own boss, either on the farm or in a small artisanship position, you know, like, I don't know. And the men left the home, and so the women were to take over the education and the nurturing of the children. And apparently, my understanding is that, like in colonial times, the men were in charge of, you know, educating the children and so forth. And then when they left, and then that was put into the purview of the women, and that's when the men started getting upset that the women were bringing up the kids, you know, mostly.
Why would they be upset about that?
Well, it seems like whenever men are in charge, they think all is well, but when the women are in charge, like, there's danger.
Okay, so women were bringing up the children, which is kind of like, I'm just trying to follow the logic here. Women were bringing up the children. That is seen very much as a sort of, female maternalistic thing, at least in across the span of society, right?
Well, it's a caretaking thing, and the men were concerned that the women were unduly influencing the kids.
Oh, okay.
In the 19th century, there was a polarization of masculine and feminine realms. Like in the 1840 presidential campaign, Martin Van Buren was described as, quote, a man who wore corsets, put cologne on his whiskers, slept on French beds, rode in a British coach, and ate with golden spoons from silver plates when he sat to dine in the White House.
Wow. That's some pretty dastardly stuff.
Well, yeah, it's feminizing him, right?
Sure.
And then the national banking system came into existence, and Martin Van Buren said that it fostered dependence. Does that sound familiar?
Mm.
And Andrew Jackson referred to it as the mother bank. A link was made between effeminacy and indulgence in the comforts of modern civilization, especially those associated with aristocratic privilege. Thus was upper-class privilege gendered feminine. And this upper-class privilege, labeled as feminine, would dog Teddy Roosevelt and later George Herbert Walker Bush.
And that was probably why W. Went out into West Texas there and bought himself a ranch, even though he'd never lived on a ranch his entire life.
Right. To disassociate himself from the upper, the aristocratic, so-called effeminacy, indeed. Well, Teddy Roosevelt, I think, was an aristocratic type. I think he was sickly as a kid, and he wanted to go into politics, and I think it was in the New England states. And he was seen as being like too effete. And so he went out to one of the Dakotas, I think it was South Dakotas, and that's when he started his Rough Rider thing, he was a really tough man's man. And then he came back and he was able to run and he succeeded. And he, that image like endures to this day of Teddy Roosevelt as a Rough Rider. Well, one thing that happened in the 19th century is that there was a plethora of organizations that sprung up to counter the feminizing effect on boys of being nurtured, socialized, and educated by women. Their central preoccupation was a ritual initiation as an induction into manhood. The generic theme of the rituals was to kill off the feminine within each initiate, destroying his bond and identification with his mother, and being reborn as a man. And some of these organizations are the Odd Fellows, the Freemasons, and even the KKK started as a fraternal order.
Really? Well, now, I know, for instance, like the Freemasons, they sort of started back in probably a lot earlier than the 19th century, but they are strictly an organization of men, that's for sure. So that would make sense as to sort of the separation and using rituals to kill off the feminine. Influence and affectations, yes.
It was common for bastardized versions of Native American Indians' culture to be employed. One such ritual involved members accusing the initiates of being a squaw who could not bear the torture. These rituals attempted to take back from Indian men the fantasies projected on them by white men, such as masculine violence, primitive and rapacious sexuality, unyielding domination of women, and the capacity to kill enemies.
Wow.
Well, sounds right to me. A consequence of this type of projection is envy. Envy for what it is perceived that others have, such as some women envy the life-giving and nurturing capacities they see only as existing in women. Anti-Semites envy the intelligence and ability to accumulate wealth they perceive that Jews have. And white racists envy what they perceive as the potency, athleticism, and natural rhythm of black men. Oh, and I've got to tell you this, like some of the quack medical devices that were marketed to men with promises to restore their manhood in the 19th century, this is going to blow you away. The Wimpus, W-I-M-P-U-S.
Wimpus? Did you say Wimpus?
Wimpus, W-I-M-P-U-S.
Okay.
A metal splint designed to keep the man erect even in the absence of desire.
Oh, my gosh.
And then another one called the Timely Warning. It was a kind of erectile iron maiden, a ring of tiny metal spikes that altered a dreaming man, that alerted a dreaming man of any danger of loss of, quote, manly bodily fluids, unquote.
Oh, my gosh. So, so if he woke up in the middle of the night somewhat aroused, then he would, oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, I'm thinking, what guy would want, you know, let me make sure I put on my timely warning.
Well, they thought that, you know, the loss of bodily fluids was like, you know, really, I mean, you know, maybe their manhood would drain out or something.
Oh, my goodness, that's terrible.
And then in the 19th century, American football was invented by Walter Camp.
Okay.
And because there's a long tradition in American culture of commingling metaphors of sports, warfare, and masculinity. But this, you know, this author, this, you know, Ducat, you know, he makes you kind of crazy with his depiction of sexual references. I mean, like, you know, like for everything.
Uh-huh.
Like, take football, for instance. I mean, although I can see his logic, it just seems kind of a stretch to go along with what he points out, like the language of football. But, like, listen to this. Football. Two groups of men trying to penetrate one another's end zones in order to score. To accomplish this, a ball carrier may attempt to go through a hole in the defensive line. Based on this language, Stephen Ducat says it's really hard to avoid the impression that football is a form of ritual combat, unconsciously symbolized by homoerotic rape intended to feminize the loser, who is commonly described as having gotten, quote, creamed. And I hate to think of what the goalpost symbolized, but you know those, you know, that's part of the vernacular.
Sure,
and that's the
absolutely
way people talk about football.
It sure is. Geronimo, if you can hang on 1 second, we're going to have to take a little quick break and let our listeners digest that last little bit of trivia.
Okay.
If you will. We're talking with Geronimo, and we're discussing Stephen J. Ducat's book, which is The Wimp Factor, Gender Gaps, Holy Wars, and the Politics of Anxious Masculinity. My name is Bruce Birch. This is All Things Reconsidered. We'll be right back.
Head on. He's back.
Yes, I am.
Listen live every night. HeadOnRadio.com.
Your computer is your radio. No static, no low power signal. It's easy. Bob Kincaid, West Virginia's number one liberal talker, is back on the air. Bigger, badder, and better than ever. Head on with Bob Kincaid, just like you remember him. Feisty, ferocious, and foremost, fact-based. No right-wing spin, no falafel, no oxycontin. Just a nightly confrontation with the facts. The issues of the day. Head on. Listen live every night.
Listen live every night. HeadOnRadio.com.
Click on air every weeknight from 7:06 to 10 p.m. Then call 877-443-2366. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. It's easy.
It's talk radio for the rest of us.
Monday through Friday night, 7 to 10.
Head on.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can now download off our website at progressive.org. Occasionally, an award recipient will take the stage and chuck the cliches and actually say something meaningful, something daring. Such a thing happened on December 7th in Stockholm when Harold Pinter, the Nobel Prize winner for literature, delivered an amazing taped address. Taped, because he's ill. But that didn't slow him down any. Basically, he let Bush have it. Not just Bush, it was Bush and Blair and Britain, too. A country he called America's own bleating little lamb, tagging behind it on a leash. Pinter boldly asked, "How many people do you have to kill before you qualify to be described as a mass murderer and a war criminal? 100,000? He said that was more than enough, and so he didn't flinch. He said, "Therefore, it is just that Bush and Blair be arraigned before the International Criminal Court of Justice. May I live so long." But Pinter not only assailed the Iraq War, which he called a bandit act, he also confronted the crimes of the U.S. Empire since World War II, noting that the United States supported and in many cases engendered every right-wing military dictatorship in the world, all the while masquerading as a force for universal good. Pinter's theme in Stockholm, in fact his lifelong theme, is the abuse of language, the abuse of power. Harold Pinter now has cancer. He appears to be dying. But on his way out the door, he urged us all to have, in his words, an unflinching, unswerving, fierce intellectual determination as citizens to define the real truth of our lives and our societies. In my own humble opinion, there's no greater task. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Now, Mrs. Johnson, before we close on your mortgage loan, I want to make sure you remember Mike.
Hi. You can trust me. I'm African-American, just like you.
So, here's the low monthly payments and interest rates we promised, and here's where they triple.
The rest of this stuff is just here to make sure that we get your house when you can't pay us back.
What a lovely house.
Predatory lenders are never this easy to spot. Call us at 866-222-FAIR and protect yourself with the facts. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Fair Housing Alliance and the Ad Council.
And we're back. This is Bruce Birch again, All Things Reconsidered, and we are interviewing tonight Geronimo. And the topic that we're talking about this evening is we're discussing Stephen J. Ducott's book, The Wimp Factor, Gender Gaps, Holy Wars, and the Politics of Anxious Masculinity. And you can actually go, if you're interested in that book, you can go to my website, allthingsreconsidered.org, and click on Show Preview. And there's a link directly to that book on Powell's book, or powellsbooks.com. Geronimo, while we were in our break, we discussed kind of how we wanted to proceed with the second half of this interview, and really what sort of piqued my interest more than anything was bringing it up sort of to the modern era and the elections that we've had and sort of the sexualization of the politics surrounding those elections. And I understand you wanted to sort of share something with us about the 1988 election with Bush and Dukakis.
One of the big things in the Dukakis 88 election was the Willie Horton ads. Okay, the Willie Horton ads were a transparent incitement of the white racist imagination. Here's a story that fueled the old but enduring fantasy of black males that they are by nature sexual predators who are after white women in particular. This also confirms the worst fear that femophobic white men seem to have about the black rapist scenario.
Sure.
He, the white male, will be symbolically emasculated not only from having his sexual property defiled by a stronger and more potent black man, but his failure to protect his women from an assault. Clifford Barnes did the narration, but he was a stand-in for another failed protector, Michael Dukakis. Elect him, the ads seem to be saying to the male electorate, and expect to be visited by armies of furloughed black rapists who will ravage your wife while you remain a helpless, emasculated witness whose terror is exceeded only by humiliation. George Bush, on the other hand, would never let this happen, as he told us in his convention speech that he would protect us. And then get this, Lee Atwater later indicated that the Willie Horton ads were designed as a specific emasculation menace to white men.
So this was not just a sort of
it was calculated. It was really
completely calculated.
So all the rhetorical assaults on Dukakis range from subtle innuendo to grotesque caricature, but the cumulative effect was an enduring image of the Democratic candidate as a feminized man. And the Republicans produced a two-page comic book entitled Magic Mike, The Real Story of Michael Dukakis, which Jerry Falwell had 10 million copies disseminated before the election. And the comic book shows Dukakis as, quote, Sheriff Pansy, unquote, a soft-on-crime, limp-wristed liberal who wears a dress and pearls. 2 weeks after the comic book came out, Orrin Hatch referred to the Democrats as, quote, the party of homosexuals.
Wow. I'd love to get a copy of that comic book, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't know. Yes and no.
Well, I mean, you know, just because of the collector's value of it.
The collector's value, yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's hard to believe that. But you know, the religious right, the religious far right, I should say, the Taliban religious right of the United States, has for years been involved in trying to influence presidential elections. And I'm not trying to get off topic, but it's just amazing to me that they're never called into question for doing that by the IRS or anyone else. It just really is amazing.
Well, let's go to 1992.
Okay.
James Pinkerton, Bush 1's campaign manager, claimed that the cities chosen for the two political conventions showed who was the party of real men. He said that New York consisted of guys, quote, on couches talking about their childhood urges, unquote. And Houston was where one could imagine guys, quote, digging in their backyards for oil. So by the 90s, the Republicans were projecting homosexuality upon the liberals. In 1992, noting the closure of New York bordellos prior to the Democratic convention, R. Emmett Terrell speculated that, quote, the convention was going to be pretty dreary for the handful of heterosexual men who will attend the Democratic assemblage, unquote. Okay, let's get into Hillary. This is important.
Hillary Clinton.
Okay, regarding Hillary, Richard Nixon said that Hillary's sharp intellect would make the Democratic candidate Bill look like a wimp. And there is a tendency in femophobia to locate an uppity woman's phallus in her mind. One of Dr. Ducat's patients, because he's a sex therapist, had this fantasy that his penis would be cut off by scissors when he was inside a woman. This is a variation on what is called the vagina dentata, the vagina with teeth, a prevalent myth fantasy in many cultures. This thinking, the vagina with teeth, in some cultures, the clitoris is considered a tooth and must be removed. So as far as clitorectomies, you know, I used to think that it was done to make women more faithful because they receive little or no pleasure not having a clitoris. But like maybe it's done extending from this myth, you know.
It could very well be. Yes, it could very well be.
And these castration fantasies aren't really so much about the physical act, although Lorena Bobbitt made it real enough and struck fear in the hearts of men worldwide.
That she did.
But I know. But it's about being feminized, like feeling dependent or controlled. In other words, pussy whipped, you know, by a woman.
Okay.
But this fantasy that this guy had, this patient, Dr. Dukakis, it's not that all men at all times and all places feel this. It's just a particular configuration of masculinity within a patriarchal society. And it seems that all the patriarchal societies from different historical periods and cultures, most social orders based on male dominance have produced men who share similar fears and anxiety. Okay, and this is important. A part of what makes these anxieties so disabling is that the women are desired, yet they are feared. You know, so there's like a conflict going on there.
Sure.
One way to manage this internal conflict is to foster the Madonna horror complex, you know, splitting women into like virtuous women. And when you think about it, you know, a vagina with teeth, that's sort of like a head, you know, making the head and the vagina kind of, you know, unfluent, like in a way.
That's just a scary picture in my mind. I'm sorry, but it is.
Yeah, so a woman's head is also dangerous because it can be beautiful, but also it has teeth. Medusa is the most famous depiction of a woman's dangerous head. So, you know, is this perhaps another reason why some men would not desire to hear a woman speak, you know, for her to have a public voice? Okay, let's get to Hillary. In 1993, after a difficult year as First Lady, Hillary said, "The idea that I would check my brain at the White House door just doesn't make any sense to me." You know, right-wing men would prefer Hillary be decapitated, that is, she not present her head with a possible phallus in it, and likewise her teeth, by speaking out and making men feel castrated. The National Review referred to Hillary as, quote, that smiling barracuda, you know, which is another metaphor which echoes the vagina dentata fantasies. Nearly all of the rhetorical assaults against Hillary, directly or indirectly, have to do with her not being a properly subordinate female. There are depictions of Hillary as a phallic woman, such as her unwifely power, ambition, and assertiveness, which are supposed to be male attributes, her chomping on cigars and swaggering about in androgynous power suits, and retouched photos of her having a penis. And Spy magazine did this cartoon, which is really unbelievable, which I'm going to be looking at right now. Okay, well, there's an article on her, because, you know, she did really well, making like $1,000 and $200,000 or something like that.
Sure.
You know, so they're doing a little article on that. And there was a retouched photo of her showing a radiant, smiling face, which had been grafted onto the body of a younger woman. She was wearing a sexy black sheer dress, which was billowing provocatively in the wind in a manner that was obviously intended to recall the famous image of Marilyn Monroe standing over the heating grate. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, unlike the 1950s bombshell, this woman was wearing a different payload. Bulging beneath her exposed male jockey shorts were the unmistakable outlines of a penis.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, really. I mean, that is, like, so obvious. Whoa. I mean, yeah. So, oh, and the thing about Bill, you know, people saying, well, what was the deal with Bill? Well, Bill is, I mean, did you remember that, you know, that famous painting of, you know, man and woman is standing there, they're on the farm, and he's got the pitchfork?
Sure.
Well, early on, you know, in his presidency, they showed that with, you know, that the depiction of Bill and Hillary, and Hillary had on overalls, and she had the pitchfork, and Clinton had on, like, this little pinafore thing, you know.
Okay.
So he was presented as the emasculated house husband, but because of Monica Lewinsky, he went to Stud Muffin, and his approval ratings went up too, because the American people just thought it was really cool, you know, that the president was getting it on.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of showed he was like what, a virile man.
I guess that's what it was. Yeah, I guess that's what it showed, or that's what they interpreted as being.
Quickly, the Vietnam War, that wounded American masculinity. You know, we all felt really bad about that. And Reagan had his little pump you up wars, you know, like Grenada and all that kind of stuff. And I think that American men feel like they've gotten, you know, their masculinity back, you know, by the two Gulf Wars.
Sure. Okay, so let's wrap this up then. Just real briefly, would you say that basically the last presidential elections, at least going back to 88, and even possibly before then.
That's right, Reagan. Started with Reagan.
Started with Reagan, okay. Have been unduly influenced by this sort of, this, how do you say that?
Politicization.
Politicization
of sex,
okay.
Yes.
How does that play out in everyday life? I mean, how does that play out in what's going on in the news on a daily basis?
Americans are split down the middle. The news is in the pocket of the administration, and they're presenting just their side. I feel like, you know, the Democrats have been very emasculated, and I kind of hate, it's really hard to fight all this subliminal stuff, which plays on, you know, people's fears, especially right-wing men fears, and also men who, you know, are not in the office, but like men who used to be like in the factories and the labor force and stuff. I mean, they're enraged. These men are enraged because their jobs have gone away. And they've been sort of trained to blame the Democrats. It's not really our fault, it's the Republicans. Economic policies, which are causing this to happen. And there's another book I read called Stiffed, which is, like, really good about, you know, what happened to American men. It really explains a lot of what's going on. And I hope that these men will be somehow awakened and won't fall for, like, all this stuff. But it's hard because, you know, it's working on their psyche and their fears, and
sure.
I think it's unconscionable that the Republicans are.
Sure. All right. Well,
incredible dirty pool. It's awful.
It is. It really is. And maybe though, if you know, I hate to say that the Democrats or the liberals will get a clue and go and fight fire with fire, and say, you know, this is just, you know, unconscionable what you're doing. But maybe
I think they should just say it right up front what's going on.
Yeah,
I mean,
just really, tell the truth.
You know, the way I have, just lay it out there and say, this is what you're doing, and this, you know, this is what the Republicans are doing, this is the way they're doing it, and that'll wake up the electorate, I hope.
Let's hope so. All right, well, thanks for spending your time with us this week, and we will try to get you back on the air sometime real soon and talk about something else you've been reading, okay?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd just like to come on when I'm inspired by something.
Okay. Well, you know, you're more than welcome to. This has been Bruce Birch, and I've been talking with Geronimo, and the topic of tonight's All Things Reconsidered was Stephen J. Ducott's book, The Wimp Factor, Gender Gaps, Holy Wars, and the Politics of Anxious Masculinity.
And I recommend that everyone read this book because there is so much material and I couldn't get to it all. And it's really a gold mine.
Thanks so much for joining us again, Geronimo.
Thank you, Bruce.
And we'll talk to you again real soon. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You know, the president came out and talked about the Iraq War and how he had a strategy to win the peace. I have some exclusive audio. This is actually him preparing for the speech in front of the mirror. This is him laying out the strategy for Iraq.
That was the most coherent thing I've heard him say in ages, man.
You know, if he really spoke that way, it would be so much better for us all. Because at least then we would know that he's an incoherent bastard. We could have him locked up.
And that's just a taste of what Bruce and I got up to last weekend. Come and join us next weekend, Saturday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. To get the stream details, go to fourthestateradio.com. That's fourthestateradio.com.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can now download off our website at progressive.org. At his speech before the Council on Foreign Relations, Bush touted the economic progress that Iraq is making, which may be a surprise to millions of Iraqis. But the thing that struck me most about Bush's speech, more than his never-never land descriptions, was his praise for Iraq's market-based reforms. These, of course, were not of Iraq's making, but of Paul Bremer's, the shock therapy of privatization that Bremer and Bush insisted upon. Bush didn't let on about that, of course, but he did praise Iraq for bowing to the dictates of the International Monetary Fund. Bush said that means Iraqis are serious about reform. What it really means is that Iraqis are going to suffer as the IMF insists on the lifting of subsidies on basic items like food and fuel. Such IMF riots are a regular occurrence throughout the Third World, and the IMF policies will make Iraq only more unstable. The Pentagon, at least dimly, seems to recognize this. The national strategy for victory in Iraq, which Bush trumpeted so loudly, says, under the category continued challenges in the economic sphere, that there's a problem of balancing the need for economic reform, particularly of bloated fuel and food subsidies, with political realities. Those realities are quite simple. People don't want to pay more for food or for fuel, not even at gunpoint. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see.
Colin Powell did it with AOL Time Warner. John Ashcroft did it with Microsoft and Monsanto. Interior Secretary Gail Norton did it with BP Amoco. Condoleezza Rice did it with Chevron. Ooh. Donald Rumsfeld did it with big boys Sears, Kellogg, and Allstate.
Of course the Bush administration is in bed with its corporate donors.
George Bush did it with Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and Enron.
Did you think they were giving it away?
Pay for by billionairesforbush.com.
All right. Billionaires for Bush, man. They're great. Fantastic. I love them. This is Bruce Birch, and you're back with All Things Reconsidered. What do I want to talk about now? Let's talk about Gene McCarthy. I think that that's probably the first thing we want to do. And I'm going to pull up something here. I'm going to read to you. And this is okay. So for those of you who are kind of young, Eugene McCarthy was a senator from the U.S. state of Minnesota, the sovereign state of Minnesota, and was a longtime member of the U.S. Congress. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1949 to 1959. And in the U.S. Senate from 1959 to 1971. In the 1968 presidential election, McCarthy unsuccessfully sought the Democratic nomination for President of the United States against incumbent Lyndon B. Johnson on an anti-Vietnam War platform. He would unsuccessfully seek the Democratic presidential nomination five times altogether. And just to give you a little bit of background on that particular campaign, in 1968, McCarthy ran against incumbent President Lyndon Johnson in the New Hampshire presidential primary, or Democratic primary, with the intention of influencing the federal government, then controlled by the Democrats, to curtail its involvement in the Vietnam War. A number of anti-war college students and other activists from around the country traveled to New Hampshire to support McCarthy's campaign. Some anti-war students, who had the long-haired appearance of hippies, chose to cut their long hair and shave off their beards in order to campaign for McCarthy door-to-door, a phenomenon that led to the informal slogan, "Get Clean for Gene." I love it. When McCarthy scored 42% to Johnson's 49% on March 12, 1968, it was clear that the deep division existed among Democrats on the war issue. By this time, Johnson had become inextricably linked and defined by Vietnam. and this demonstration of divided support within his party meant his re-election was unlikely. On March 31, 1968, Johnson announced that he would not seek re-election. I have, and just so you know, Eugene McCarthy died yesterday morning, and I have some audio that I was able to dig up that I want to play for you. And this audio is actually was recorded in 2002 and was done at this by the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And here it is. Okay. 1 second, and we'll start over.
Next, a professional? Or
well, I think it has to be accepted. I think one reason that we find in the cases of corruption in politics, of the kind of almost venal corruption, but when you find a man defending himself by saying he wasn't doing anything in politics that wasn't acceptable in the business of the professional world from which he came. And sometimes he's quite right. It was wholly proper and acceptable in that other world, but in no sense or realization that when he took on public office that the standards of conduct or behavior or even professional standards that were wholly acceptable outside of politics had to be changed and applied differently within the office.
Yes.
And that it's, in a sense, the two things. One, the idea of calling or of accepting, but also of making a commitment to what you're doing. And I think that we can't go back and to the old formal relationship of medieval time, but I think we have to stress more and more, and in a way I've made this kind of judgment with reference to my own conduct, but things like certified public accountants, for example, that the idea of profession and of social responsibility, I think, have to be emphasized much more strongly than it's now emphasized.
Of course, politicians do say that they do talk as if they have this sense of social responsibility.
Well, they do, but in I think something like the resignation of Rockefeller, for example, as the governor of New York, indicates, and the acceptance of it, a lack of reflection upon the office of the governorship, which he took, was in a way a public trust, which was given to him for 4 years.
Yes, so it was.
And for him to say, well, I'm just going to quit now.
And yet there was very little criticism of that move.
It should have been. Well, I think that if he had moved up in his own party, if he'd become a judge or become the vice president, but to say that, you know, you can just give up the office short of fulfilling the term because you want to.
Is there anything in your own career, Senator, which made you come to these conclusions?
Well,
crisis or
no? I don't think there was any crisis. I think that I sort of thought in terms of contract and commitment. I'll give you an example. I was offered the ambassadorship to the United Nations by President Nixon in '69, and I said, well, I would take it if they could get the Republican governor of the state to appoint a Democrat in my place in the Senate. Because I didn't think I had a right to yield the Senate seat to which I'd been elected by the Democrats in my state to a Republican in order to take the UN ambassadorship. The governor wouldn't do it. I think the Nixon administration were much relieved when he wouldn't. But in any case, he wouldn't do it, and so I turned down the appointment. And so I've recognized it myself, and I think that in much of my conduct in politics, and I've been in politics 25 years, I've tried to make the judgment within the context of certain sort of philosophical ideas, such as one I've talked about, and also, as far as I could, within my judgment of what the movement of history called for by way of
yeah.
political action.
It seems to me your attitude, which you began taking 25 years ago when you first entered politics, is peculiarly pertinent in our own time. Perhaps you were 25 years ahead of your time, but...
I think some of our troubles now are that you have to have, I think, a reasonable relationship between your philosophy or how you your principles, I suppose you could call it, and the policy you develop to sort of realize them, and then the program. And in so many areas, I think of national concern today, we're out of phase. I mean, we have a great philosophy with reference to equality before the law, but the program is somewhat removed from that.
Somewhat ad hoc.
That's right. And we have, I think, a wrong philosophy or theory of poverty in this country. We keep pretending it isn't there, and consequently we can't develop any realistic or effective program for dealing with a reality which we refuse to acknowledge as existing.
This is the sort of thing you seem to continually think about, Senator. Emerson once said that a man is what he thinks about all day, and, I'd add to that what he does all day, too. Could I ask you what you do with your waking hours at the moment, and what do you think about as you do it?
Well,
is that a difficult question to answer?
It varies some from day to day. I generally am in the process of either anticipating a speech that I'm going to give somewhere, or an article I'm going to write, or work on a book which I have in progress. And sometimes the thoughts with reference to them are desultory, and I try to anticipate at least to what I have to do next. And I do less reading, I think, now than I did 10 or 15 years ago.
And that was Eugene McCarthy, who was the senator from the state of Minnesota and was also a very much against the Vietnam War in a time when, the existing Democratic leadership was very much in favor of the war because the Democratic leadership was in charge of the country at that point. We also, this week, lost another great personality, I guess is the best way to put it. Richard Pryor died also yesterday, and most everyone knows who Richard Pryor was. He was born in 1940 in Peoria, Illinois, grew up in his grandmother's brothel. His first professional performance came at age 7 when he played drums at a local nightclub. A gifted storyteller known for unflinching examinations of race and custom in modern life, Pryor shattered many barriers for American stand-up comedians such as Robin Williams, Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock, Arsenio Hall. Remember Arsenio Hall? David Letterman and others. Though he frequently used colorful language, vulgarities, as well as racial epithets, he reached a broad audience with his trenchant observations. Pryor was often ranked among the best stand-up comedians, although he rarely got his due among American audiences because he was too controversial. He actually died yesterday of a heart attack, and I don't know if this is going to be irreverent or not, but, the bottom line is this man was pretty irreverent himself. So here's this clip. This is Richard Pryor, and this is him talking about a heart attack.
Anybody here ever had a heart attack? No, motherfucker never admit they had a heart attack, right, Bill?
No, sir, I never did. I had indigestion one time.
I don't care what nobody tell your ass, boy. I was walking in the yard and somebody said,
"Don't breathe no more." I said, "Huh?" I said, "Don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me." Okay, I won't breathe.
And I tried to ease a little air inside of my mouth. And I said, "Say, did I tell you not to breathe? You told me not to breathe. You told me not to breathe. Well, where you going? Why you walking? Stand still." "Okay, I'll stand still. Get your ass down. Okay, I'm down. Don't hurt me. Shut the fuck up. You think about dying now?
Yeah.
Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, motherfucker?"
Oh, man. Okay, well, maybe that was a little irreverent. And if so, if you're offended by me playing a clip of Richard Pryor talking about a heart attack when he actually did die of a heart attack, then, I guess maybe your sense of humor could use a little job as well as mine. But he died yesterday after contracting, or he had multiple sclerosis for about 10 years before he died. And there is actually, if you go to NPR.org, there is a really excellent interview on Fresh Air that Terry Gross did with him about 10 years ago that you should check it out if you can find it. We're getting close toward the end of our program. It's about 10 minutes till the top of the hour. And I'm going to go ahead and go through until the end of the show, since it doesn't make any sense to do a break at this point. And there's a few stories that I wanted to talk about, and I really want to get into this one because I'm really sick to death. Okay, now, I am a strongly anti-war person, okay? My anti-war views have gotten me involved in a number of other political activities, including World Can't Wait and some other things that are out there. You can, if you want to know more about that, you can go to worldcantwait.net. But, you know, the one thing that really is upsetting me, I guess, and it has continued to upset me, is the fact that the opposition party that is in place is not really an opposition party. It's like the Democratic Party keeps moving closer and closer to where the Republican Party is in order to try to win elections. You know, and I know that Bill Clinton got elected that way. And I know that you know, Al Fromm, I guess is his name, who is the father of the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, you know, keeps talking about how we have to play the centrist path, and you know, and I got to tell you, I mean, I have watched this, and I've watched how Democrats have consistently become more and more disgusted with the National Party because of the fact that they keep doing this. Now, you know, I'm hoping that someone out there eventually hears this recording who is at the national level in the Democratic Party, because, you know, I'm nobody special. I'm just a guy who is who's doing a radio show on Sunday night. You know what I'm saying? Not anything special. But, you know, to no surprise, what did I find when I opened up the Washington Post? And this is going to be in tomorrow's paper. Senator Clinton crafts vague stance on war with eye to 2008. This is by Dan Bowles, I don't know how you say it, B-A-L-Z, Washington Post staff writer. At a time when politicians of both parties have eagerly sought public forums to debate the war in Iraq, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has kept in the shadows. Clinton has steadfastly stayed on a centrist path, criticizing President Bush, but refusing to embrace the early troop withdrawal options that are gaining rapid favor in her party. This careful balance is drawing increasing scorn from liberal activists, such as me, frustrated that one of the party's leading lights has shown little appetite to change Bush's policy more directly and embrace a plan to set a timetable for bringing the U.S. forces home. And I'm sighing. You know, when you hear me sigh, you know that I'm just... you know, again, I get fed up. You know, Clinton is supposedly confronting the Democratic Party's long-standing dilemma on national defense. Well, you know what? I don't think there's a long-standing dilemma. If there is, then it's with someone else, you know, because everyone that I talk to understands that national defense is very simple. And it means one thing, national, which is the nation, right? You know, the country, the U.S., whatever, the national, defense, which means that you are defending yourself from something. Okay? Well, what this current president decided he was going to do was change that from national defense to national offense. In other words, let's take the fight to the enemy. Instead of fighting them here, we'll fight them there. Well, you know, how well has that worked for us? You know? One can't help but look at some of the things that have happened in Iraq to see that we're in fact probably creating terrorists faster than we can hunt them down and send them to secret prisons in Romania or wherever else the secret prisons are in Eastern Europe. So, I mean, I can't help but, you know, what is the other thing that I saw today? You know, again, you know, the numbers are coming out of Iraq. You know, the news organizations are trying to poll the citizens there to try to find out how they feel about the occupation. And what they're getting is exactly what they're looking for, you know, and that is that the people of Iraq want us out. So, you know, Senator Clinton, get a clue and, you know, get a backbone, for God's sake. You know, stand up and stand for something. I guess that's what really gets to me worse than anything, you know, anything else, is that when I vote for a leader, I want that leader to say to me, this is not a popular stand and I understand this. This stand that I'm taking is going to polarize a lot of people, but you know what? I believe in what I'm doing. You know, and I will do what I can to carry it through regardless of my political future. You know, Okay, there's my rant. At least there's part of it anyway. Just so you know, we may be gearing up again for another judicial filibuster. Woohoo! Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said Sunday he is prepared to strip the Democrats of their ability to filibuster if they try to stall Samuel Alito's nomination to the Supreme Court. The answer is yes, Frist said when asked if he would act to change Senate procedures to restrict a Democratic filibuster. And here we go. The same old, same old. Supreme Court justice nominees deserve an up or down vote, and it would be absolutely wrong to deny him that. Okay, well, let's see. The president nominated a fascist. And if you're in the opposition party, you do anything, you know, you try to block it by any means necessary. So there's that. That's my thinking. I mean, I could be way wrong. Maybe it's that you're supposed to lay down and just take it, you know. And they're in charge now, so we should just let them, you know, run the clock out, and hopefully they won't screw the country up too bad. Well, folks, I ain't buying it. You know, if there are an opposition party, they need to start acting like it. And last but not least, last Sunday, and this is something that we're going to be covering in the Fourth Estate Radio program also this week, out of Australia, there has been a number of race riots there. That apparently is directed at Lebanese Australians, and apparently some Lebanese, or the story goes that some Lebanese Australians attacked some, you know, Anglo-Saxon guys at some beach, you know, and apparently as a result, there's been all these race riots down there. And the you know, from what I'm hearing from my friend John Fox, who is down there, and also from another friend, that the media is actually being somewhat complicit in the carrying out of some of this stuff down there. So look forward to that being in the news this week with Fourth Estate Radio next Saturday. But before I get out of here, I just wanted to let you know that this has been our 19th show, and I'm really grateful to have been able to present this show to you. We are coming up on the holidays. I am planning on streaming live Christmas night and New Year's night. So if you're around and you're at home and you're looking for some live entertainment, please check us out here. Okay, so grateful to have been with you tonight. This has been All Things Reconsidered. You can reach us online, allthingsreconsidered.org. Please stay tuned for Peter Werby and his show. Archives are at whiterosesociety.org, chatting at tomhartman.com. Don't forget to listen to Bob Kincaid this week, headonradio.com with him, and next Saturday night, fourthestateradio.com, and then Sunday, Rama, homebodies.ramabahama.net, and then with me following that show. Have a great week. This has been Bruce Birch with All Things Reconsidered.
For listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
But they've hijacked the entire system, so they can pretend like they're embattled, even though what Christians are, about 80% of the people in the country identify themselves as Christians. There's churches everywhere. There's God stuff on the money, and there is God and the Pledge of Allegiance and all of this. I mean, it's all done. I mean, it's really, I don't know. What is it? I was going to say it's all done for political purposes to divert us from considering what's really important to us socially and politically and economically. But they truly are whacks. Wacko. Not like W-A-X. Like wax. Like W-H-A-C-K-S. They're totally wacko, and they have this public forum. I mean, that's...